I didn't quite know what to say, so I replied, "Well, I'm not sure I would put it that way." But I was struck by the degree of his agitation. My numerous conversations with third world savants convince me that they are disgraced by American greatness, and that their anti-Americanism is a way to salvage pride. Multiculturalists have a different reason for objecting to American superiority. In their view, the United States cannot be morally superior because no culture is morally superior to any other culture. The multiculturalists hold that there are no universal standards by which cultures can be judged better or worse. All cultures are basically equal. This, of course, is the multicultural doctrine of cultural relativism. This doctrine was first articulated in the early part of the 20th century and has been adopted by multiculturalists in the past few decades. Multiculturalists are committed to cultural relativism in large part because they see it as a weapon against racism. Racists are prevented from asserting the superiority of their culture because the very concept of superiority is denied at the outset. Cultural relativism also appeals to American intellectuals in general because they don't like approaching other societies with the presumption that their own way is always better. The presumption of cultural equality strikes them as a much fairer and more reasonable way to study other cultures. As a methodological starting point, the premise of cultural relativism seems unobjectionable. Before we know anything about the Papuans, we might fully expect that they have their Proust and Einstein. In examining that culture, we should, of course, be very careful to allow for various forms of knowledge and discovery. Their Proust may not closely resemble our Proust. Their Einstein may have produced an entirely new conception of the universe. But it is also possible that we will discover that the Papuans have virtually no literary tradition, just as many cultures have gone on for thousands of years without philosophy. Equally disconcerting, we may find out that the Papuans have only a very rudimentary understanding of the operations of the natural world. In this case, we cannot reasonably continue to insist that Papuan culture is fully equal to Islamic and Hindu and Western culture. It is sheer intellectual dishonesty to proclaim the best we can say is that Papuan culture is simply different from other cultures. Rather, we must revise our relativist assumption and conclude, wistfully perhaps, that Papuan culture is, in some respects, inferior. I emphasize the phrase, in some respects. I am not suggesting that there is any absolute standard by which one can proclaim cultures superior or inferior. The Papuans could excel in other areas, such as face painting or coconut juggling. There is no set of norms in the Platonic empyrean by which we can objectively rank cultures. Nor is there any purpose in staging a cultural Olympics that awards general prizes for superiority and inferiority. Certainly, groups and nations are free to dispute the criteria by which progress and excellence are usually judged. The Amish, for instance, reject many aspects of modernity. They generally avoid cars and telephones, although I recently read that they have established a website to market their products. Even so, the Amish clearly value the solidarity of their community over the convenience of many of our technological contrivances. They have chosen to go their own way, and nobody considers the Amish inferior for this. But the situation is very different when one considers, for example, the main racial groups in America. Despite their various differences, Asian Americans, blacks, Hispanics, and whites in the United States have the same objectives. All want to be in the entering class at Berkeley and Yale. All would like more seats in the boardroom at Microsoft and General Electric. All seek a greater representation in the Congress. When groups agree on the prize, when they define success in a similar way, it is entirely reasonable to ask which cultural strategy is the most effective to achieve this goal. As I have earlier argued, the assimilation strategy of the immigrants is simply superior in today's world to the protest strategy employed by African American leaders because it leads to more rapid upward mobility and economic success. But the concept of cultural superiority need not be limited to groups contending for a specific prize. One might also find some cultures to be superior to others in achieving universal aspirations. Do such aspirations exist? Of course they do. Anthropologist Donald Brown provides a list of them in his book, Human Universals. One such universal aspiration is the desire to speak one's mind. In the West, we call this the right to free speech. But of course, this right is not recognized in many cultures. In the late 1980s, the novelist Salman Rushdie made some satirical references to the Prophet Muhammad in his book, The Satanic Verses. The Islamic world was not convulsed with laughter, and in February 1989, the Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa calling on Muslims to punish Rushdie for his crime of blasphemy by killing him. Rushdie, heretofore known as an intrepid iconoclast and debunker of Western civilization, now begged the West to protect his life. Rushdie and a group of writers held a press conference in America in which they indignantly accused the Ayatollah Khomeini of not having sufficient regard for the First Amendment. Rushdie himself called the Ayatollah's attention to the works of John Stuart Mill. Unfortunately, Khomeini was not well schooled in the rhetoric of multiculturalism, otherwise he could have replied, "What gives you the right to impose your Western values on me? You have your cultural values, and I have my cultural values, and mine are just as valid as yours. Your values give priority to free speech, but my values give priority to outlawing blasphemy. Rushdie is free to express his cultural values by saying whatever he wants about Islam, and I am free to express my cultural values and order that his head be off." This is impeccable multicultural logic, and if the doctrine of cultural relativism holds true, then the Muslims would seem to be fully justified in attempting to murder Rushdie. The only way to make the case against such an action is to argue that the principle of free speech may be Western in its origin, but it is universal in its application. This is another way of saying that the Declaration of Independence and the United Nations Charter are correct. There are universal human rights. These rights may not always be recognized or upheld, but the failure of a government to enforce them at a given time does not invalidate the right. To recall Lincoln's statement that I cited earlier, the right has been declared so that the enforcement can follow when the circumstances allow. By denying that there are universal standards of human rights, multiculturalists become de facto apologists for tyranny. They are so concerned about one culture imposing its morality on another that they ignore the fact that such impositions are sometimes indispensable to protect human dignity. Early in the 19th century, the British outlawed the ancient Indian practice of sati. This custom called for widows to be tossed onto the burning pyres of their husbands. The British also passed laws restricting child marriage, female infanticide, human sacrifice, and the caste system. In curbing these charming indigenous customs, the British were clearly imposing Western morality on their colonial subjects. But who today will dispute the results? Multicultural textbooks are strangely silent on these questions. The doctrine that all people have certain basic rights does depend, I will concede, on a certain conception of human nature, one that ascribes a certain special quality or sacredness to humanity. There are other human aspirations, however, whose universality does not depend upon a philosophical premise of this sort. Recently, I was visiting my family in Bombay, and I noticed that on the outskirts of the city, a group of American anthropologists had set up camp to study the displaced peasants living in huts. As one scholar emerged from his tent, sporting his blue jeans and adjusting his zoom lens camera, the peasants eyed him enviously. They eagerly told him, "We want your jeans. We want your camera." Appalled at this suggestion, the anthropologist drew himself to full height and said, "But I am not here to convince you that our way of life is better. Oh no, I am merely here to study you. I believe that your culture is fully equal to ours. In fact, in some respects, you are spared from the rat race. You are closer to nature. You are ecological saints." The peasants cogitated over these remarks and then repeated in unison, "We want your jeans. We want your camera."